This is Barry Tyker from the UW-Madison Archives Oral History Project. I'm going to be interviewing Sarah Pollock today. Today is, by the way, it's the Ides of March, March 15th, 1989. We're sitting at the in Sarah's kitchen. The tape recorder is resting on the table that she wrote her dissertation on. Sarah got her PhD in communicative disorders from the university. How many years ago?
It was less than 2 years
ago. Less than 2 years ago, at the age of 77. The topic today is twofold. It's her career here at the university, but it's also, I'm going to call this interview, A Life of Learning. And Sarah, why don't you begin by telling me about your early influences in terms of your intellectual development, your early years of curiosity as a youth.
Well, I came from a family. I was the youngest child and the only girl in a family of five older boys and myself. And my mother and father had come here at the age of 19. And although they came from a small town, there was always some love of culture with them. They always went to the theater and took me along because I was a baby. My grandfather was very close to the whole family. He was very much of a patriarch figure. And he was, while he was not a rabbi, he was a reverend, and he did many of the things that a rabbi did. But one of my earliest recollections is the fact that every afternoon he would go to the synagogue, and together with about maybe six or seven of his peer group, would study the Torah every afternoon. Song. No matter what the weather was, my grandfather, very frail, ethereal sort of person, always went. And that was my first contact with the love of learning, that to him this was the most important thing. And it was so moving that when he died, these colleagues with whom he, not colleagues, but his friends with whom he had studied every day, gathered around his coffin and they wept because he had been the leader of the study group. Mm-hmm. And so this was inculcated in me when I was a very young child.
Where did you grow? Where does this take place?
Takes place in Chicago. We lived in Chicago on the northwest side. My father saw it while we were middle class and we were not rich. We were, moderately well-to-do. Every one of the boys went to college. It was taken for granted that they would all go to college. When it came my turn, my father had died 2 years before I graduated high school. And I wanted to go. My mother said, no, the girl didn't need to go. That anything the girl had to learn, she could teach the girl. But it was the boys who had to go. And it wasn't that there wasn't money, it just that was the way the life of a girl was in those days. But I determined, and I always asserted myself, that I would have as much as my brothers did. And finally, after 2 years, I persuaded her and I went back to school, but I did. By that time, it was almost the Depression. And I worked my way. I worked very hard. I was in sociology, and I would work from 4 in the afternoon to 10 at night on the population project that was being done there. I earned enough for my tuition and my living. And once in a while, my brother would give me $5 and I'd get a dress, you know. And yes.
Did your brothers help you? And besides,
well, it was depression. Nobody had any money. It was all we could do to just get along, mm-hmm. because we did have money. But my mother had put everything in second mortgages, and she lost everything, and was dependent on my brothers for her living. You know?
Did your brothers incorporate the same love of learning that you did?
Some of them did. I will say that they all had their degrees. They were professional people. They read a great deal, they loved music, and not all of them, but 3 out of 5, I would say, did. They feel that I have gone further than any of them in that respect. They're very close to me and very protective, but in a sense, they're very proud of me, because, again, learning in our house was the most important thing, as it is in a Jewish family, you know, mm-hmm. that learning is has the first priority, especially among the males. And I was always, probably along the same line, I was a voracious reader. And I was fortunate, I went to the Eleanor House, where they had a library, that is an association house. And they had a very fine librarian who took an interest in me. At that time, I was reading the library, out of the library of one of my girlfriends. I read a book a day. But it was just the girls' stories and all that. But no matter what it was, I read. And when I was 14 and went to the Association House, this librarian started me. The very first serious book I read was New Thompson, Growth of the Soil. And that just overwhelmed me because it opened up life. I mean, before I was reading these little...
Did you select this book?
She selected it.
Yeah.
She started to direct my reading. And before I was 15, I was reading the Russian authors. I read Tolstoy. And I shall never forget Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. I was all of 15, I think, at the time. And it made me so frightened that I was looking under the bed and in the closets because I was so afraid that maybe I would be seized with a desire to kill somebody. Here, this you went through it, and this man was just obsessed, and he fought against it, and he finally did it, and I thought, this could happen to me too, you know. And I wrestled with these feelings. It was a terrible period. But I read a lot of the Russian authors you can't imagine, and then went on, by that time, was going to college, began reading, but always I had read. But I was very fortunate in being directed.
Besides the book you just referred to, were there any books that influenced you, perhaps in a more positive way, in terms of your attitude toward learning and toward what you were going to be doing in the future?
It's so hard to remember because, as I said, I read indiscriminately and I read just voraciously. That was, you know, I used to read at night under the bed covers because my mother would come and turn on. See, I had my own room because I was the only girl. The boys had to double up. So I could read at night, you see, under the covers until my mother would come in and turn the light on. Sometimes I would read to one or two and I was a little girl yet, you know. But
Now you're going on to college.
Mm-hmm.
How unusual was it in your location and
it was
for
not.
A young girl, a Jewish girl, to go on to earn her way through college?
That's interesting because a number of years ago I went to the 50th reunion of my high school. It was just the most revealing thing because there was a booklet in which it told what everyone did. Now I came from a very upward group in Chicago, in Jewish, almost completely Jewish. Some became very wealthy and moved on to the suburbs, but 92% of our graduating class went to college. Now that was a long time ago in the 20s, so you can imagine. It was not unusual for the girls to go, you see. I had a whole group of friends that I went to school with at the University of Chicago.
You went to the University of Chicago?
I went, and that too, you see. I went at a time when, I forget who came in at the time, Hutchins. And so it was a very open program. And I would take my courses, or not even go to class, but I would go to other classes. You know, Leo Rosten, for instance, was one of our friends. He was Leo Rosenberg at the time. And we would all join him and go and hear his classes on international relations. And we'd visit each other's classes. We had such a broad education. And then all I did was study up for my exams, you know, the departmental five courses, and pass them, just take the exam, and didn't always have to go to class. So that we really wandered around and we had a wonderful exposure to different subjects and different disciplines and all.
Was Hutchins talking about the great books, or did that come?
Yes, Adler was there, and they all were there, and there was a very rich, a very stimulating environment. It was, and all the friends that I was with, I mean, we would sit around at night, light candles, play music, and we would discuss, you know, as you always do. Mm-hmm. You don't do it so much anymore, but we would sit and discuss life and problems and philosophies. It was a certain group that I was with. Most of them went on, the girls went on to become social workers.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be one, but most of my friends at that time.
So was that an accepted avenue then for young women?
Oh, yes. Oh, when I went to college, my brothers told me I could only be, I wanted to be, of all things, I wanted to study chemistry. And this, I think, has some implication, not because of the science, because you were searching, you were examining and discovering things. Relationships. And that was very interesting. My brothers, however, said I could not go unless I became a school teacher or a social worker.
Hmm.
So, you know, I was limited there.
You talked about, tell me about some of the influential teachers or classes that you had at Chicago, at UC.
Well, I had Burgess, who was one of the outstanding people in sociology. I did my work, as I said, in sociology. And he was a very inspiring man. And then I had Redfield. I somehow always remember Redfield, tall and lean. He was one of the early professors in anthropology. And I took a course, you see, at Chicago in your first year, you took a lot of survey courses. And so I took a survey course of anthropology and sociology. And that was really a marvelous course. I really loved it, and I think have always been interested in that area because of Professor Redfield. And then there was history. I to this day, I enjoy history, and I do visit classes, you know, always every semester I audit, or I don't audit it, I mean, I just, I'm a guest in courses. And I find myself gravitating a great deal toward history. And I think part of it was due to the history professor I had. Of course, he was a young man, and he played with the Bears on weekends. And we were so enamored, and we thought it was so romantic. And he'd come with patches on his eyes or his face, you know. But he taught, it was a history course, not of a specific period, but it was, again, a survey, but it was European history, but the entire development of European history. I found that very interesting. It was a tremendous amount of reading.
You don't happen to remember his name, do you? That historian?
It started with a B. It started with a B, and I can't think of it right name.
And he played for the Chicago Bears on Sundays.
He played for the Chicago Bears on the weekends.
That's great.
And I remember those particular courses. As far as English and all, we had to do a lot of theme writing, which I didn't like very much. But I did like German. I took German. But I had a familiarity with it. And I went through the three, like for instance, at the end of the second quarter, I was told to take my year's examination because I knew enough. Mm-hmm. And so I went through it. Now, one of the reasons I took German, and this is my friends here who are in the German department find this very amusing. I had, when we first started going to the university, I read a great deal. Oh, we were in love with Vashel Lindsay, and who's this other one? Very similar. She's become very much in vogue again. I forget some of the writers of the early part of the century, the poets. And we would quote, and we were just full of it, you know. And I had been reading Heinrich Heine, which I just loved. But I felt that I was missing so much because I felt instinctively that the German was much more beautiful. So I really took the German to read Heine, which I did. To this day, I can quote Heine in the German because it's just so beautiful. And that was one of my, but you see, I always had reasons why I was taking things. I just didn't learn automatically, this is what you assigned me, but I had reasons for wanting to learn things. And I think I was like a sponge. I mean, I just absorbed things. And to this day, I think I'm still a sponge. You know, I never can get enough of things. There's always so many interesting things to do and be excited about.
So you graduated in 4 years?
No, I did not graduate, no. At the end of my third year, I was one of the friends in my group was a young woman, Henrietta, who was a singer and very fine voice, and we were very good friends. And the group was meeting at different homes for music and talk, and it was her turn to have the group. She lived in a very beautiful apartment with her parents, and I met her twin brother, Henry, and we fell in love and we married. And I dropped out of school because he hadn't finished college, and I thought, well, I don't want to compete, and we really didn't have the money. So I dropped out at the end of my third year, and then I had my child a year and a half later, and he was killed when my baby was 4 months old. And then my whole life changed, because then it was a matter of providing for my son. Even then, I had to go back to school to learn some profession. And my brother, who was a CPA, told me to go back to Northwestern at nights, and if I got my developed my skill, that I would be able to earn a living take care of my son. Mm-hmm. And this is what I did.
Let's get the year here first, so we have an approximate.
That's the year 1938.
Okay, go ahead.
And I went back, I got jobs, and I went to school three nights a week at Northwestern Accounting, and I marked papers in order to pay for my tuition, and took care of my son. My weekends were completely devoted to him. And I did that. I went all the way up through income tax accounting, and then I worked for various accounting firms until my brothers, who had a syndicate, real estate syndicate, they were attorneys, hired me to manage certain properties, and I did that. And it was 12 years after my first husband's death that I finally returned to school, and I was close to 40. And it was something because I hated, and toward the, as it went on, I hated it more every day, the kind of life I was leading. I hated the business world. I was very good at it. I made a lot of money, but I hated it because I just didn't like, it was making of me something that I wasn't in order to deal with businessmen and who felt women weren't very important, you know, or I was in a administrative position and they just couldn't take that either. And so it was making me develop in a way that was so contrary to my feelings. So I saved money. I saved up to $2,000, and one day I told my brother that I wanted to go back to school. I was 39. And I said, is it right? He said, it is. If that is what you want to do, it is right for you. I cannot say to you what I would do, because that's not important. It's what you want to do, and if you want to go back, you just give me a couple hours a day, the afternoons, and I'll give you your full salary. And he really helped me. And I went back to school the following fall, and I was traveling from the south side of Chicago to Evanston. I would get up and I would leave 5:30. I would get up 5:30. I'd leave. Took me an hour and a half. I'd have to be on the L by 6:30. My son would get up and get himself ready for school, and I would study an hour and a half on the L each way, learning anatomy and physiology of the vocal mechanism. You see, I wanted to be a speech therapist.
Okay, let's talk about that. Now, you've already made that decision. When did you, let's go back.
Oh, all my life I wanted to be a speech therapist. You see, I had a very bad speech problem. I had a lateral lisp, which is called a spitty S, an S-S-H-C-H-N-J. And my brother, just next to me, 2 years older, had the same thing. But when we were in elementary school, our school was one of the experimental schools, and so we had one of the two speech therapists in the entire Chicago school system, and she worked with me, and I adored her. She was an English woman, and I developed the most perfect English accent that people all the way through college would say, were you born in England or on the East Coast, because I spoke as an English woman, you know, very precise vowels. My brother never had it, had therapy, and he always had his lateral lisp. And I was so enamored of it, and I thought it was so wonderful what she had done for me, that I determined that was what I was going to do for life. I never forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went back, I went to Chicago didn't have that program. I went to Northwestern. And I traveled for several months until my brothers, through some influence, got me an apartment in Evanston. And it was then, about a month later, that I met Felix, my husband, who I married subsequently, 6 months later. But it was a very hard thing. I must say, I think some of the hardest times were when I first went back after 12 years to go back, and here I was 40, just about 40, and here all my colleagues in the room were 21, 20. And you know, I found out at that time that I had the ability to relate to these young people, because I felt as young as they were, and I developed very good friends. We studied together. We confided together. It was really a wonderful period of my life. It was just marvelous. And I remember I was coming into class. One of my favorite professors, Dr. Westlake, was really a tyrant in a way, but he was a marvelous professor. And I would come into class a few minutes late every day because the bus, by the time I would get my bus, you know, and get there, or get the elevated and then the bus, I couldn't always help it. I wouldn't make it. And one day when I walk out, very sarcastically, he said to me, "It wouldn't hurt, Miss Allen," I was using my maiden name, "to try to get her on time once in a while." And I was so angry, I turned to him and I said, "If you had gotten up at 5:30 and traveled an hour and a half and got your child ready for school, I think I'm doing pretty well coming within 5 minutes late." And what I didn't know is he liked that. He liked people to be independent and to stick up and not yes him. So we became very good friends. And ultimately, after I took my bachelor's, he gave me a grant to take a master's, and giving me a TA, of course. In fact, he gave me two TAs. I almost killed myself. I was working as a TA in the children's hospital and working TA in the clinic. Plus, I had my son who was going to high school, plus my husband, and cooking and keeping house. And at the end, when I got my master's, they offered me a grant for my doctorate. They said, "You will not fulfill your potential if you don't take your doctorate." But I said, "Well, if I did, I probably wouldn't live, because I couldn't possibly have done all I was doing." But that was the way I did get my degrees.
Now, I assume that from what you said about having all these young people around, that a 40-year-old, it was not real common for a 40-year-old woman to go back and continue.
Absolutely. There was nobody there my age. Fortunately, I'm small and I look young, and I think this helped, you know. And I had the enthusiasm that these young people did. I could relate to them. No, nobody did. Nobody did.
What was your degree officially in?
It was in speech and hearing.
Now, are you married by the time you get your
degree? Oh, yes. Yeah. I was married. I married 6 months after I went back to school, and I took my degree in less than a year. And it was my husband who insisted I take my master's. And that was really wonderful, because very few people took their master's in my field at that time. It was in speech. We were in the speech department, you know.
Were people who took master's, did they generally go into academe, or did they go into practice in the field?
Many of them went in academe. I have friends, my colleagues with whom I took master's are the head of departments all over the country, mm-hmm. very prominent. And others, like in hearing, became specialists in that field. And others with masters really had administrative positions. It was almost equivalent to what a doctorate is today. In those days, very few people took doctorates in our field.
What type of reputation did Northwestern have?
It was one of the top ones. At that time, Northwestern had one of the best programs. We had marvelous people. Westlake was in pathology. And believe me, I know pathology. It really, what he did and what Michael Bust, who was in language, did for me, and that was taught me to be a diagnostician. That is one of my greatest strengths. I am a good diagnostician. And that is because we went very deeply into pathology. And the work was very difficult. It was very difficult. But after I finally got back to studying again, then I was all right. But the discipline that I had to exert upon myself was very, very stringent, and it stayed with me the rest of my life.
The courses that you took in anatomy and areas like that, were you generally with your speech pathology associates,
yes.
or were you with medical students?
No,
and
speech pathology.
Just speech pathology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, see, Dr. Westlake wanted to be a physician, but he had a disability of his arm, and that prevented him. But he took all kinds of medical courses, and so we knew the muscles. We used to call him Old Muscle and Nerve. That was our nickname for him, because we had to know every insertion origin of the muscles and the nerves. It was just imprinted to this day in my mind, you know. But you know that when you make me recall that after I took my master's, and after I worked a while, we came here at Madison, I continued my studies every summer. Every summer, I took courses. And so that in a way, when I did my doctorate, I wasn't rusty or anything. Mm-hmm. Because what I was doing when I took my master's created a momentum that lasted me the rest of my life, yes. and also the curiosity, which is one of my big things. I mean, I studied all these things because I felt I needed to know. I've never been, and I think this is good, and my son inherits that. He said he runs scared. He's a doctor. He said, I run scared all the time. In other words, he checks everything he does, and he goes back to his books, and I always did the same thing. And I always created problems for myself in therapy.
You see? What do you mean?
Well, when I was in Chicago, I after I took my master's, I worked with a hospital for a while, but then I was asked to join the public schools. It was a very good deal for me. And I asked for the high schools. They were developing programs in the high school. And one of my colleagues went on sabbatical, and they asked me to pick up her schools for a year. And I chose DuSable, which was a totally black high school, 2,000 black students, because I felt that I didn't know enough about problems of the black. And this was a way for me to learn. But when I got there, I realized that speech problems, I mean, articulation at that time, or stuttering, was really the lesser of the problems they had. The problems they had were that part of it was the dialect. For instance, the teacher teaching shorthand and typing said her big problem was that they were teaching the shorthand system where the Pitman, where there are three positions for the vowels, and you wrote above the line or on the line or below, but depending on the vowel. Well, when you would have the word like bed, eh, that was a middle position. But the students would say bed. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a different position. Mm-hmm. And when they would verbalize, they would have different. She couldn't teach it because they had a totally different vowel structure than what she did. And it seemed to me, I created my problem there, that it was more important for me to teach them the correct vowel and consonant pronunciation that would permit them to be able to learn subjects that could get them a job. A job was the most mm-hmm. important thing. And also how to speak more properly, say, even if you're in a gas station or even social situations. I worked with the teachers and developed programs with them. For instance, I developed a whole series of tapes for the shorthand teacher. And the student would record, and then they'd listen to me say the same word, and then they'd try to match my pronunciation, so that we had all kinds of tapes for them and different programs to teach them. And this are sort of things that I mm-hmm. always like to do. In other words, find out what is the need, then create the program for the need. And as a result for what I did there, I formed a basis of my philosophy of teaching, you know, children who had problems, is what was the need and how could I meet the need. Now, it might not be what you would say was the criteria for doing therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, I was not at no time have I ever been interested in perfection of speech, because it depended what you were using it for. And so, you see, all of these experiences have been cumulative for me. I always built on them.
Now, it's graduation day. How old is your son at this point when you're graduating with your master's, approximately?
He was about 17.
And it's what year?
It was 53 when I got my
53.
Master's.
53, okay. Mm-hmm. And you're married to Felix at this point.
Yes.
It's graduation day. What are you seeing in your future, in your field, and where do you go? Where do you go at this point?
First of all, I had a job with the university at the Children's Hospital, but the director of speech correction in Chicago schools had asked me to join them, and I did because I needed the money. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the experience, and I was tired of working day and night. And so this is the time, and I knew my son was going on to college, and this might be a problem too. And I talked about that a little.
Okay. Now, where did this happen? Where you went into schools?
Chicago.
And how long did you do that?
Until fetal. All right, we can go on that now.
Okay.
Are we on? I worked at the public schools for about 4 years, I think it was, until Felix, or maybe about 3 years, I'm not sure, But Felix got an offer to be rare book librarian at Wisconsin here. And at that time, I left. And I came up here to get a job. And I had one of my classmates was head of audiology here at Wisconsin School of Speech, or speech, they didn't call it communicative disorders then, but that was the same department. And he asked me to come in and do a doctorate because they needed someone who knew public school work, and they gave me a TA. Mm-hmm. And I took a year to my doctorate then and decided to go back into public schools. The department here at that time wasn't too well developed, and I was not too enamored of joining, and I felt that if I took a doctorate, I would close myself in. The only places you could work were either the university or the hospital, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I felt that this would not give me enough room to develop. And so I went back into the schools and worked there and became a supervisor of speech correction, and then or speech therapy, and then ultimately coordinator of speech, language, and learning disabilities. The reason that I could take language and learning disabilities was that, first of all, my work at Northwestern and Masters, a lot of it was in language, and then I always took courses every summer when I was here. And when the State Department of Public Instruction decided to license the coordinators and supervisors, they found that I had enough credits to be supervise learning disabilities because I had been interested. Mm-hmm. And so all they did, one of the professors waived my clinical work because I had so much work in the hospitals that I was able then to be coordinator of speech, language, and learning disabilities. And I came at a time, when I say language and learning disabilities, there was no language disabilities in the schools. I initiated and I developed it. Again, there was the need. And I found a way to meet the need, and that was to develop a program of language disabilities. And I had taken over the learning disabilities when they just worked on visual motor coordination. And I merged it with the language disabilities and made it a total learning program rather than just specializing in visual motor activities, which was the what they were doing at that time. So that I feel I was very instrumental in developing and starting this program in the schools. And along with that, really my career took off because it took a lot of training of the therapist, because there was no program in the universities on language disabilities. And I worked very hard to develop that along with the learning disabilities. And I did that for a number of years until I had some very severe surgery. And as a result, I thought it was best to return to teaching, because it was the work as a supervisor and with all the new programs and developing it was very strenuous for me.
Before we get back to teaching, let's go to your developing these new programs. Where did Madison's program fit in terms of what was going on nationally at that time?
We were very much in the forefront. What I established was a self-contained classroom. There was work going on an itinerant basis, same as speech. But they didn't really understand what language was about, and we didn't even know how to test for language or cognitive disabilities. And I was able to establish a half-time, pardon me, a half-day program, but even the fact that we had a classroom for language disabilities, we were the first one in the state. And when David Yoder came here at the university to open the language program, he visited my classes and he said that they were better than anything he'd seen in the country. So that we really were in the forefront. And I based that, the reason for that, on the fact that I had been doing work with Michael Bust, who was one of the pioneers in this mm-hmm. field. Furthermore, again, it was the need. There were children who were in kindergarten, first grade, who were picked up for speech delay. but who could not be remediated. Somehow they just weren't making any progress, yet were bright children. There was no question. And I recalled some of the things that Michaelbus had taught us. And these children were fitting into this pattern of minimal brain dysfunction. And so it was practically breaking down doors because I couldn't get the money even for a half a day program. Everybody thought we had enough speech therapists. They didn't understand what language is about. Everyone always thought it was simply the grammatical structure and that it is one of the things, but certainly not it. And so it took almost a year and a half until I finally got enough money to open up a class. And then we had so many children, we had to just choose those that were not expendable, you know. It was a slow work because I had to train the girls also. We did a strong training. We really had a remarkable group of therapists who really worked on this. And I think today we've got one of the finest departments in the country.
What, now, Madison Schools hired you, so they must have had a commitment to this area. They did not.
They hired me originally as a speech therapist.
Then so I became, expanded,
and then I became a supervisor speech therapy. Then I introduced these.
You introduced these?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you work much with the university?
They didn't have a program.
There just wasn't.
They knew nothing about it. We knew more than they did, Barry. I mean, it's funny. But it was when David Yoder came, and then Dee Vetter came. And first week she was here, we had lunch. She asked me what I was doing. And I did work with David and Dee once they were here. They started developing courses.
Now, when did they come about?
Oh, Dee came about maybe 22 years ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're talking mid-60s, mid to late 60s, somewhere in there.
Yeah, we're talking mid-60s.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think I started the program about 67, I'm not sure. Somewhere in the mid-60s. And it was about the time that Lee was working on his doctorate, too. Because when I became
Lee
ill...
Lee Greenwald we're talking about.
When I became ill, I had been in some seminars with him. And he was working on his dissertation, and he wanted to get a job. And I had decided to return to teaching, which was unheard of. They could not deny it to me, because the policy of the board said I could do that. And I asked Lee if he'd be interested in taking my job. And he was. And because we both had similar thoughts and ideas, and we were right at the beginning, this is why we have worked so well in subsequent years in our writing and in developing the programs. And so it was all in its very infancy at that time, because we were flying by the seat of our pants. When I had one therapist who would go out and do some diagnostic work, or she would do some therapy at Van Hise one afternoon, she'd come in after school and we'd figure out what she had to do the next day. We really were doing it just trying to figure our way through it. We wrote, I wrote a chapter in a book Lee and I did on the Madison School program for a book called Language, A Key to Learning, one of the first books that was out. We described the whole program. And so I continued, when I went into back to teaching, I, again, you see, I don't know how things fall in, but I was working I just started at Midvale, which I had worked at before. Mm-hmm. I just took back some of my schools where I had very good connections. And the teacher of the mentally retarded group, the educable group, had children who were 8 and 9 years old, and she came to me and she said, I always made myself available to teachers. She said, I'm having a problem in math. They cannot understand before and after. So I said, no problem, I'll come in, you know, never realizing what I was going to do. It was one of the most momentous, critical points in my career, and I didn't recognize it. Mm-hmm. So I went in, and I thought it was going to be easy, and I suddenly found that I was really in deep water.
Had you ever dealt with this kind of...
No, but it was a concept, you know, and we were talking about concepts in language and language training, you know, at that time. It was a very big thing, and it was a concept of before and after. But when you begin to, and subsequently I find a lot of articles on this particular concept before and after, which is one of the most difficult ones. And as a result, I worked with these children, developed the program, and we were able not only to understand what number came before which and which one number came, but they were having trouble with alphabetizing, which has to do with the concept of before and after, you see. And before and after, you couldn't learn unless you knew in front of and in back of. I mean, so we had to go back to the physical aspect of space, you know, mm-hmm. and the spatial relations before we could deal with the math. And when I got through, one of the teachers in another class of MR said, well, why don't you come and do this for us? And I said to Gretchen Fair, who was the state supervisor speech therapy, I said, my God, I wish I had it on tape. I wouldn't have to go through this again. And the next day, the director of Title III called me and said, I hear you got a good project for a grant to develop a program for teachers. So she came over and we talked about it. And the next thing you knew, I was given a nice big chunk of money to develop teacher training programs on language development concepts and all of that.
And so it was really this one teacher calling you into the classroom that really sort of opened this gateway for you in this area.
It's the one that she died recently. She lived close by. She became a librarian afterwards. You would know her if I told you. Anyway, as I say, it was so... How do you account for it? Is it, as I said to you before, things open up and you move into it because you're interested. And I was very curious then how to do it. And I developed this program. And I called Lee, and Lee and I had been writing together, and he went in with me on the project, the Title III. And we developed the program, we developed all kinds of activities, and by that time, instead of teaching then, I was here on this grant, you see. And I got quite a bit of money. It took almost 3 years. We worked on it 2 years, and then we did a trial balloon with the teachers in developing it, you know. And as a result, we wrote the book and videotape. We had videotapes and manuals. And eventually the university wanted to produce it, but then eventually University Park Press asked to do a book on it, and then it was bought out pro, and the book is still being used, but all started with a teacher calling me in. And as a result of this, Lee and I have done workshops all over the country.
Now, this is dealing with the area you're dealing
of
with.
And
with mentally retarded or with everyone?
We made the program then for regular classroom because I wanted to go further, is how to prevent or remediate it right in the classroom as part of this classroom teacher's problems. In teaching, you cannot separate language. I now was, of course, in language completely, no more speech. And I've been in language and learning disabilities for the last 20 years now. But what I try to bring out is how it all develops from simply finding needs and being curious as to what was happening and trying to be creative. Because I call this creative teaching, and also what's the other term, which would be a diagnostic teaching, you might call it. And so you see, things have happened. I've just moved in and moved up and up, and so I did that until I retired, but then I always kept writing and doing workshops for quite a long time after that, until one day I decided to do my doctorate.
Okay, before we get to the doctorate, you said that Dave Yoder and Dee Vedder came here in the communicative disorders. Boy, it's a mouthful to say that. The communicative disorders department. That's sort of an indication to me that the field was starting to take off at that point. And
yes, the field took off. And Wisconsin has an outstanding language department. The master's level is a language level. And now, of course, they're moving more into pathology, but up to now, they've had one of the strongest department of language disorders. Yeah.
And as you're retiring now, and Let's talk for a little bit about any association you've had with the university.
May I just say, though, Barry, that between 40 and 65, and what is usually termed as the tapering off period of your life and your career, is when mine took off. At 40, it started and it really began moving after about 10, 15 years. I mean, the best part of my work and most exciting has been between 40 and the time I retired at 66. And so, you know, it proves that it isn't the 30 to 40s that you have to get going. You can start at 40 and really have the best part of your life and your career.
And we're only talking 40 to 65. We're still not talking about the PhD thing. That's that's coming down the pipe just a little bit. Your association with the university. Your husband was a curator of rare books at Memorial Library for many, many years.
Yes, for 16 years.
For 16 years. Mm-hmm. What kind of contact did you have with the university, aside from your professional? I'm not talking about your professional.
I had a great deal of contact because we have very, very close friends, mainly with the German department because my husband was Austrian. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, with communicative disorders, I've always had a very close relationship with the department, and I have done talks there, and they have sent their students to us, so we've had a close relationship.
Okay. Go ahead. We're talking about your relationship with the people. Mm-hmm.
We had, our whole social life is in the university here. And this is contrary to what we had at Northwestern, where we mixed as much with the townspeople as we did with the university, but here, all of our whole life was with the university, with the different members of departments. We had a very active social
life. How do you account for the difference between here and Northwestern?
That's hard to say. I think part of it is that this is a university town. You see, Northwestern, while they certainly had the campus and they had dormitories and all, you had Chicago adjacent to it, and you had a lot of students from Evanston and the suburbs. Somehow it wasn't, well, there may be a lot of people that just had university friends, but we had both.
Mm-hmm.
My husband's poetry life was more of the townspeople, and maybe that's why we had many more. But here, we knew people in so many different departments, and to this day I still have very close friends, and I associate myself. Of course, we took advantage of everything, the musical, the theater, and all. And my husband participated also in different other activities besides just the rare book room, mm-hmm. because he had his writing and his talks and his performances and all of that.
So you have retired from the Madison Public Schools. Your son has left home at this point.
My son had already had graduated and become a doctor.
A doctor. Felix was still working on his career here, or had he retired also?
Oh, he retired a year before I did.
A year before you did.
Because his eyes failed him.
Okay, so now my question is kind of an obvious one. You finished 1 year of PhD. What motivated you to, at age whatever it was, 72 or 3?
No, 75.
75.
I did my doctorate in about 2.5 years, which was very fast, yeah. I know, everybody thought I just raced through it. What motivated? See, I was 66 when I retired. And I was doing workshops for quite a few years. And we traveled. My husband needed me more and more to help him because of his increasing blindness. And I was keeping busy. I have to be busy intellectually, but I found that more and more I was absorbed with what he was doing. And therefore, my whole intellectual life, or my whole life per se, was geared upon about taking care of his needs. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like I was being more absorbed into his world. We'd always had our own individual lives, which was good, and we had a very close relationship with people together. Our interests were, we had interests in common, but we had interests of our own. And it must have been festering in my mind. It's the only way I can put it, because it gave expression. One day I had lunch with Barb Nyberg, and we were just talking, and she said, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And I said, I think I'll go take a PhD. Just like that, I mean, without thinking about it. I suddenly said, I think I'll take my PhD, finish my PhD, and she almost died. She said, that I never expected. Why? I said, because I never finished it. And I have to finish things. And furthermore, there's so many things I still haven't learned. And I'd like to know why I did some of the things I did intuitively, and I would like to understand it more. And she says, but you'll never use it. I said, that is not why you study. You don't study to use it. That is a sort of an after effect. You do it because you want to do it. And it's important, just the doing is important. And having said it, I went back and I talked to Dee Vedder, and I said, what about my coming back? She says, I think it's a good idea. And you see, I have to always have a life of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I said, well, let's see what I can get back. And I found that I could get credit for everything I took that 1 year, 20 years ago, because I did finish my minor sequence in child development. I had passed my examination. And when I went back, they had changed the numbers, and it was now in family science or something, but they were still teaching the same courses. And they gave me credit for everything. And while I had not done a thesis master, which you're supposed to, Dee Vedder had been my evaluator of the project that I developed in the school, the research project in language. And I had written it up and directed that whole thing, and so I was given credit for that. So all I had to do was to refresh my knowledge of my coursework, and then to see what was happening. And since then, it took a year for me just to catch up on things. And I think a year and a half before, and part of that, I was already working on my prelims. And instead of having four professors, I ended up with five. Because David Yoder was out of town. When he came back, he said, I got to be on your committee. I'm your oldest friend. I got to be there. So we filled him in. I had a very hard time, but I had one of the most interesting prelims. I really did. And so that it was a lot. But when I came back and decided I could do it, I came to Felix and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to take a PhD. He said, fine. And there was no question about it. And I said, I'll find time. I'll always take care of you. And the thing that pleases me most is when I finished, which was only a half a year before his death, he said, the most wonderful thing, it's wonderful that you got your doctorate, but what was even more wonderful is that you always took care of me and the house. We never suffered for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't easy. Because I want to tell you, when you say I wrote my dissertation on this table, I wrote from 4:30 in the morning until 11 o'clock in the morning, before noon, every day. Because the rest of the day I had to be available to take him places. He was blind by then.
Mm-hmm.
I had to take him places, pick him up, do the errands, do the cooking, and I'll be in bed by 8 o'clock, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this took a lot of discipline.
I'll bet it did.
This took. But it was so fascinating because my subject was something entirely different than what they usually have in language disabilities. I went out of my field into psychology.
Tell me.
Because I had read an article. I read this article and I said, this is it. And it had to do with the choice of the attributions that children chose to explain why they failed or succeeded, or why they failed. The attribution means the reasons that children give for failing. And I read that article, and I thought, I wonder, and the reasons that they give could be divided into four different categories. One would be very closely associated with a loss of self-esteem. And we knew that learning disability children had very low self-esteem. And I was wondering how much of that it played a part in their not achieving. That this was the biggest problem that learning disability teachers had, that motivation. And the motivation was tied up with self-esteem, whether you could think you could do it. So I thought it would be a very interesting subject to see the differences between children with who learn normally and those who had learning problems as to the choice of attributions to see whether we could use that as an indicator of what the child felt so that we could deal with that problem. If they chose the reasons that show they had low self-esteem, then we would move in on what we call attributional retraining to build up the self-esteem in order to, you see, but I wanted to find out the differences. And there had been a study similar, but not with the learning disability children the same way. And so I worked up my problem, which was very new to all of my professors in the department. I had to practically give them the material to read because it really was in psychology. But I was trying to move it into, and that, you see, again, I stretch. Mm-hmm. And the only way that you really stretch, I think and I'll tell you, that in working on my doctorate, my thinking improved. I was always what they call a divergent thinker or intuitive thinker. I became a logical thinker during that time. And my processes, my thinking process, it improved. My ability to study improved tremendously. And I could sit 6 hours and study where my colleagues who were 35 could do no more than two or three. Mm-hmm. But I could sit 6 hours and I would be fascinated and couldn't wait to get back to it. Where I got the energy and strength, I don't know. I really think it is that the mind really controls your mm-hmm. body here. And if I have all this energy and health and all, I think it's because my mind is so active and interested. And it's all I can attribute it to. Because I think that mentally I'm a much better person.
Did you ever have any moments of doubt at 4 in the morning on those cold January mornings when you were getting up to come out here and do
this?
Listen,
there came one day when I walked in Dee's office at my usual weekly meeting. I took everything I had and I threw it in the waste paper basket. I said, "To hell with it." And she said, what's the matter? And I said,
"Did you literally throw it in the waste
paper?" I literally threw it in. I had to pick it up out of there. And I said, well, I was really upset. And she got very upset, too. She thought maybe she wasn't meeting my needs. And we straightened it out again, of course. It was a very big study. It was a big study.
Yeah,
and I did it in a year. But the reason I did it in a year is that I knew every principle, practically. And a good many of the learning disability teachers I had hired and trained, and everybody moved in to help me. Mm-hmm. You know, if parents didn't respond, they called the parents up. And I could move in any school. And when one principal said, "Sarah, we'll have you, but there's not a room available," I said, "I'll create the room." And I said, "You still got the old blackboard?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, put them up in that end of that corridor where it's blocked, and we'll block it off." Because I had dealt with that before for my therapist. I would create my own rooms and all. And I really did my research in a very fast time. I had money, of course, for statistics. You get 300, and I got a couple of statistician in the computer center who were marvelous. My advisor was in psychology, and he understood. He was one of the few people who understood my subject, and everybody went out of their way to help me. I mean, everybody was so interested in helping me. And I didn't think the day would come when I would finish it, but I did.
Do you feel that your age at the time was a help, a hindrance, or that it didn't make any difference in terms of your perception, in terms of the perception maybe of your faculty?
Well, I have no sense of age to this day. I always say that my colleagues, we had our own floor mm-hmm. in the department. We had our own offices, and we mixed around. We all helped each other. They were about 35, and they treated me like I was 35, and I felt 35. I honestly did. I could take the four flights of steps without even stopping for a breath. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were just wonderful. And the day before my orals, I got calls from all, you know, we were about six of us. I got calls from several parts of the country wishing me well for my orals.
That's great.
You know? We had such a close tie. To this day, I still correspond with some of them.
I'm going to stop right here. We're going to start another tape because I have some more questions.
Well, that's what you wanted to.
This is Barry Tyker. I'm with Sarah Pollock still. It's the 15th of March, 1989. You were saying that you got these telephone calls from several people the night before Earl's. You said earlier in the discussion that your prelims were very interesting. And you didn't tell me how or why they were interesting.
Well,
so.
Here were five people that I knew very well throughout my years of teaching. I had had contact with all of these members in connection with their work and my work. And so I felt very comfortable with them. They didn't spare me work, I will say this. I know that one of my professors had me look at the research that was done over the past 10 years in language disabilities and to evaluate the work that had been done along several criteria. And I had done that. I had over about 100 research papers. And I had made it on regular letter size sheets. I had laminated it. I had it across my whole wall when it had to be looked at so that he could see it. And that was a very amusing way of doing it. Anyway, when it came to the prelims, I had discounted a great many of them. I guess I might have sounded very arrogant, but I wasn't. I knew what worked and didn't work. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that they would build on research papers that were done where the population selection was very, very suspect, you know, because I knew my field well enough from a not only theoretical, but I knew it from the practical point of view extremely well. Anyway, they would ask questions and about my what I thought about certain things. And when I would answer, I would turn it around to them. And I would say, well, do you think the preparation that you have done would result in this kind of or would end in this kind of a result as far as practice is concerned? And it turned out where we were arguing about whether the preparation that they were giving was sufficient to really help us in the schools do the kind of work that we did. And I was suggesting that some of them really ought to go back and take a look at what we were doing in the schools, you know. And one would say to me, do you believe in pragmatics? Because he didn't, and one of the other professors did, you know, and he wanted me to support him. And I'd have to be very diplomatic, mm-hmm. you know. But I kept throwing the questions back to them and putting them on the, see, I was supposed to be on the defense. And I ended up, I was putting them on the defense. And we had the most spirited conversation, most spirited examination. And in the end, Dee Vetter summed it up. She says, what I hear you saying the last 2 hours, she was my advisor, mm-hmm. is that you think we're creating the problems of the learning disabled. Is this what you're saying? And of course, this was a big thing because I am saying that we're creating the problem rather than exacerbating it rather than diminishing it. I thought a while and I said, yes. I think that is happening, and I gave my reasons, I gave my points, and I gave examples one after the other, where if children were taught properly, you would not have some of these learning problems. There were real language problems, but there were a lot more pseudo-language problems, and I began to show how the emphasis on certain things. And one of them said, well, what should we do about it? And I said, there's nothing you can do about it because the parents expect a lot of this. The only thing that's going to help us is when the money runs out and we have to be a little more careful and a little bit stricter in what we're doing and not create the empire that we have. And many of them agreed with me, you see. I knew Dee Vetter did, mm-hmm. too. But I questioned a lot. I mean, in other words, I question them on mm-hmm. some of the work that they were doing.
So your goal in the prelim was not simply to get through the prelim, but to make it
I was an equal. Yeah. But the reason I know is that Dave Yoder asked me to address his class about 2 weeks later, and he introduced me by saying, I just Sarah just had her prelims. It was the most interesting one and a meeting I've ever attended. She had us defending ourselves instead of ours making her defend her, and she had some very good points. But you see, I was able, and I was fearless. I mean, I said to them, I don't care. You know, I don't need a job. You know, I can say what I want. I said, it's the most wonderful free period of my life. But in a way, I complimented them. I felt it was a compliment to them to discuss professional matters on a high professional level. Mm-hmm. And this is what we did. We talked about concerns and problems and what needed to be done and what needed not to be done. And because this is what a prelim, I think, should be. It is not just specific items that you discuss, but rather that you encompass all of these items into the whole. Yeah. And this is what is very important to me. I find too much fractionation, not only in learning, but in the way in which we're treating, diagnosing, and remediating our children. There is entirely too much fractionation, that what we have to do is look at it as a whole. What was the word I would like to use? It's not only holistic, but the it's a German word, the Gestalt. Mm-hmm. And we lose the Gestalt. And this is what's wrong with all learning right now. And I think this is what I constantly strive for.
And this is getting to the generalist-specialist debate.
Exactly, and, yeah.
Are you saying perhaps we've gone too far toward the specialist?
Yes, there's no question. Medicine is trying to come back to the generalist.
What about your field? Is it trying to come back?
Oh, I'll tell you, you get into ego problems. Too many empires have been built, mm-hmm. and people don't want to release their empire.
Is the next phase in your field going to be not the Empire Strikes Back, but the empire gets its due, or is there going to be a taking apart of this down the road a little bit by the
Well, with everything, everything is a cycle. Mm-hmm. And you always have your, the revolution around. It always comes back mm-hmm. to what is really, I think it's the way nature makes it happen, because it's the homeostasis, you know. You have to come back to where the harmony is there. Mm-hmm. And you swing from one to the other, but you always come back to the center. And that's what we find all the time. There are all kinds of new ideas that they get. You know, things that are part, your work in pragmatics, your metalinguistics. I mean, I wrote an article on metalinguistics, tore it apart. Because it is part, they took it out of linguistics or out of language and learning in order to examine it. That is fine, but they forget to put it back in. They create a whole new discipline with all new terms. Then you have to find out, what you mean is really mm-hmm. this. People do not talk in very simple, explicit terms. They talk around it. They use many, many words that really don't need to be used. Well, that's a whole different
tape.
But I've tried, and maybe because I'm older, I can say those things, you see. I don't have any problems with, well, I guess I never would anyway. I mean, that's one of the advantages of studying when you're older. You can think independently. You have more confidence. Even though you disagree, that's fine. You can disagree as long as you do it politely.
That was a question I was going to end the interview with, but since you brought it up, let's talk about it now. What advice would you have to give to older people about returning to school?
You have to have a reason for returning to school. To return to school just to have contact with people or to fill up your time, that does not solve any problem except to fill up time. Mm-hmm. I think you have to say to yourself, what am I interested in? Everybody is interested in something. Maybe you don't know it, but if people would just let themselves feel more and just, I think you find out what you're interested in by knowing what you're not interested in, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Like we teach the children that this is a truck because it is not a car. This is a yellow because it is not blue. And the same thing with all learning. You know what you want to do by knowing what you don't want to do. And sometimes it's a sifting process. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm at a sort of a limbo because I want, you know, after all, my time is limited now. And I want it to be very meaningful. And I've been very busy settling my husband's estate and doing a lot of things for him. And now I'm looking ahead. And I'm trying different things by being very careful, because I now understand that I have to create what I want to do. And it has to be something that I feel is fulfilling, and that has always some creativity. To people going back to school, keep as open a mind as you can, and don't let yourself get absorbed in very minor detailed things, unless you like to do detail, that's fine. You have to know yourself. You have to know who you are and what you are, and have the courage to be what you are.
I'm going to ask you a tough question that probably philosophers have been debating about for centuries. You've mentioned it on this interview, and I've heard you talk about it many other times. Tell me what you mean by instinct.
That is a difficult thing.
Because you rely on it. You're a very firm believer in that, unless I've been misreading.
Intuition.
Intuition.
Yeah, I believe in intuition. Instinct you're born with.
Okay.
Barry.
Let's
instinct,
use intuition.
Instinct is part of you.
Let's use intuition then.
And that goes back to what Jung would call, you know, the previous lives, mm-hmm. and so forth. Intuition. I am a firm believer in intuition. I think, because I am basically a very warm, emotional person. Let's contrast it with intellectual approach, where you have to think about everything and justify it or figure it out or know whether what's going to happen, or if you do it, your choices and all. Intuition is not just feeling. It is a sum total of everything you experience and you think about and you feel about. It is not a consensus, but rather the merging of all that you are. Now, When I say thinking, you have thought enough about things so that this thinking is already,
mm-hmm.
part of you.
Mm-hmm.
When you feel about things, unless you're uncertain what you feel, then that will bias your intuition, or you have trouble with it. You know whether you like or you don't like,
mm-hmm.
whether you admit it or you don't, or what you are prone to have biases apart or not. This you build up. See, intuition isn't something that you have when you're young and you keep it. No. It's something that you develop as you grow, as you experience, as you suffer, as you fail, as you succeed. It's a sum total of all of your experiences, which then is like a computer, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
And when I have to make a decision, certainly I will use my thinking on it,
mm-hmm.
no question. But at the same time, I will ask, how do I feel about it?
Mm-hmm.
That will be my intuition, not just my feelings, because the feelings are composed of all the things I'm talking about. I don't know if this makes sense.
Yes,
to you.
Well, it was your intuition then that spoke that day when you were having lunch with Barb Nyberg about going on to school, because That's one of the things I was thinking of.
Yeah.
You've mentioned a couple of instances that have similarities to that.
Yes.
Where it was like something inside of you had already made decisions
that's
that maybe
right.
you weren't even aware of.
That's
at
right.
that point.
And we all of us make decisions that we are not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
You see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only thing is that sometimes we check it by saying, well, should I do what I feel that my intuition tells me to do this? But on the one hand, if I do it, this will happen and this will happen. And you begin to then constrict it or rationalize it. You see, we do a heck of a lot of rationalization. And that the minute we start rationalizing, then we're not doing what we want to do. And if I come to a point where I have to make a decision, I don't know, I base it on my intuition. I use my intuition a great deal with my relationship with people. And it does not fail me.
Yeah. We're going to go back a little bit. This is really how I wanted to end the interview, but
we can transpose it.
You were writing a book also, and you just had a book. You had a book published about 3 years ago, I believe.
Yeah, but
you're revising
it. We finished it.
You wrote it with Lee Greenwald, yeah. Who's a director of student services at the Madison Metropolitan School District, the person who took your job when you
That's
went
right.
back into teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me, describe that process. How did you've talked about it a little bit already, but how you and Lee got together on this and the development of it and the...
Well, as I mentioned,
I think you said you wrote it here on this table also.
Well, that was the book, yeah, we wrote it here. But as I say, originally he helped me with the grant that we
right.
got, the Title III.
Right.
We found that we were very compatible. That is not to say we didn't fight, but we could iron things out. We're both strong people, but our minds were compatible. And I could only express it after we started working together in writing, particularly in the writing, we would start, and it was almost like a physical sensation that our minds locked. Because people who sat in and listened to us write thought it was weird. I mean, because I would start a sentence, and I'd be halfway through it, and Lee would then complete the sentence. Exactly. Or he would start, and he would say something, and I would change a word as he was talking, so that together we would almost every sentence we were working on together, which is unusual. Mm-hmm. Most people write, you know, by themselves. But our minds were so tuned to each other that even now, when we hadn't worked on the book for some time, and we started a couple months ago, we did the same thing. We would discuss if we had problems. We outline a great deal. We're very organized. We both are very concise. And we would discuss beforehand what our focus would be and what we wanted to do. And when we would work on something and it wasn't coming, and we would stop, and I would say, we don't know what we want to say. We're using too many words. Now, let's discuss what is it that we're trying to say. Exactly. We used extremely simple language. We used no jargon, because it's my feeling that if you can't say it in simple 25 penny words, mm-hmm. you don't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That we use words to confuse almost, or to generalize, because we're not sure specifically what we want. This I attribute to my husband, who had a great deal of gift in the precision of every word. It had to mean exactly what it said. But Lee and I have, we've enjoyed it, because it's been a very, kind of an exhilarating experience to do that.
Did you ever have a strong desire to write a book?
I had difficulty ever writing. I was so self-conscious about writing. I always used too many words, because I wasn't ever sure that what I wanted to say was the right thing to say, or that I was erudite enough to have said it, and that maybe I ought to check to see if it was right or wrong. Had no confidence. Is when Lee and I started writing almost 15, 20 years ago. Throughout the years, I have learned to think through my writing and to be able to think very clearly what I wanted to say. And it's become a very enjoyable process as a result. I like to write now. Even my letters are better. Lee thinks I write well. He has said that. I think I have, not inherited, but I've been certainly influenced by Felix on that. There is such a wonderful feeling in expressing just what you want to say, which is very difficult, because we don't know what we want to say.
Mm-hmm.
We have a general idea,
But when we want to transpose it into a written form, it is the most stringent of all expressiveness, I think. You know, speaking, it's much more difficult than speaking, where we can use body language and use other things, so that we have no cues. It is on the paper, it has to be just what it says, and in a form that's interesting. Is that what you...
Yes, that's exactly what I want. Your first love in the field of speech was dealing with people who stuttered, I believe.
And had articulation.
Articulation problems, because that was your initial area. It sounds as if your PhD was in an area that was significantly different from that. Do you keep in touch with your first love? Do you have a chance to...
Well, a few years ago, some of the therapists in the schools asked me to come and tell them how to work on an R. And I said, I haven't thought about that in years. But I did go, and I remembered all the things, you know. And it was fun to do it. No, I haven't done it in many, many years. More years than I can remember, maybe 15. The reason being, perhaps, that it's become too simple for me. I mean, there's no challenge to it. See, I thrive on challenge. I really do. Give me a problem, and I'm off and running. In fact, we haven't discussed what I'm doing now. I'm working with the university now.
My next question, go ahead.
I'm tuned into you today.
Yes, you're finishing sentences already.
Yeah. As I told you before, I'm trying to find a niche for myself. I have to have, while I'm slowing down, I really am, and I travel a little more, I have to have something that I'm very interested in. And I need to do that for the rest of my life. And somehow, Dee Vedder said to me, I think you ought to work with adult students. And so I did locate the Center for Continuing Adult Education, perfectly wonderful director, Carla Heimerl. And when I called her and I said, my name is Sarah Pollock, she said, oh, I know you. And I said, have we met? She said, no, but you're on the brochure of the Center for Continuing Education. And so I went to see her, and she was very excited because she knew all about me. And on the brochure, they have me carrying my books. So some of the publicity when I took my doctorate, they photographed me on campus, I'm carrying books. And there, you know, in the brochure, they say, it's never too late, you know, I'm carrying my books. And so she wanted to have a couple of coffees with Sarah, women from 30 to 40, 40 to 50, who could come and talk to me about the problems of going back and, you know, solutions and so forth. And I did. It was very interesting. But as I said to her, this is not my cup of tea. I feel embarrassed by it. I do, because I don't... Oh, I understand that certainly they think it's remarkable the older woman goes back. I don't find it remarkable, because it's just doing what I've always wanted to do. I'm lucky that I have the mental capacity and the physical. All right. I said, I want to do other things. So we've been working on different projects, and I'm working with her, and I'll be doing a little research. I'm interested right now in what are the other universities doing with continuing adult education, particularly on recruiting and attracting minorities. See, our minority older women are going, men too, to MATC, because they have to get a job and earn some money. But I'm wondering what other universities are doing, and whether we are doing enough to attract and help to get money or funding for women who maybe have had some MATC or would like to come back or get a degree or do something. And so we're beginning to work on that project, and I'm doing some research. I believe in going down to the bottom. I want to know what other universities are doing. I don't like to reinvent the wheel. And so right now, at this point, I am doing library research on what has been published in these areas. And you see, in a sense, I'm doing what I always did do. I'm creating my job.
That's right. I was just going to say, you're creating another world, in a sense.
Yes, and also it's something that Carla's very happy about, because she has very little money, relies on volunteers, and what volunteers are interested in this sort of thing, you know. And so we talk a lot about these various things, and I have a lot of contacts with different people that I introduce. And so we're beginning to see how we can work, and we have a very nice personal relationship.
Briefly, what kinds of things are you finding out in your research?
I haven't really delved into it enough, no, I don't know. I do know that Michigan is supposed to have a big program, but I don't know, and I don't know. I'm sure it's no more than 5 years old. And what I'm trying to do, Anne, is locate, I mean, in order to do it very efficiently, is locate the magazines that would be publishing work, because I feel that most of the information will be in magazines, right, in journals right now. And so what I'm trying to do is, I've got a couple of journals here, and I'll see where things have been published in the bibliography, mm-hmm. and begin to try to form some sort of a center of information that we could tap into. And then we'll see, we're just playing it by ear. But there is now, for instance, one of the things I did do already is that they get printouts every semester, and they were able to get some information about GDP, the general grade average.
GPA.
And her superior was able to do that, because we do know that they're doing very well, the returnees. But there was information there that she didn't know, and I took all of the printouts for last semester. And having done statistics recently, I went through it, and I had certain questions, and I was able to find a lot of information. Particularly, Carla was after the School of Engineering to offer a scholarship to an adult student, and they said, we don't have any. And I looked, from analyzing it, there were 19 students, older students that they didn't know about. And, I mean, they have given a scholarship, but she was able to justify it. And so I gave her a whole bunch of analyses of the different things that were happening at the different schools and the different age groups, different GP and GPA, and also by gender, you know. And this was very interesting. I spent mm-hmm. days just analyzing that. So I was able to offer her that she was looking for that information, but had no time for it and no particular aptitude maybe for it, and didn't have anybody. So I was able to do that. And now I'm going to be doing some of this. Where it goes from here, we don't know. Mm-hmm. The other thing is I've just been invited, I will probably be invited, to join the committee here on the Year of the Book that the Library of Congress has declared this the Year of the Book. A little different than the literacy, because it has to do with books itself. Mm-hmm. And it's all librarians, and one of my friends on there thought that I should be invited to be a different source, you know. So it's possible I'll join that group. So as Carla was saying the other day, she says, you're like a magnet. Things are attracted to you rather than you go out and look for them. But these are the kinds of things that suit me. And I like it. It feels good. See, it's got to feel good. These two things feel good. And I don't know just what it will mean, but I'm beginning. And also, I have to find more time to read. I mean, I just don't get enough time to read anymore, and that's bad. So
I'm going to end it with, that's the beginning, and I don't get enough time to read anymore. I think that's a perfectly appropriate place to end it. Thank you, Sarah. This is Barry Tyker from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. That's the end of the interview.